It's a great pleasure to have Philip Feist in today's colloquium. And so he has done lots of important work on quantum thermodynamics, and also he has done nice work on covariant error correcting code. And he recently had very great results on complexity growth and uncomplexity and so on. So that's probably something he will tell us. So please.
Thank you very much, Benny. Thanks for the introduction. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into this talk. It really is a great pleasure of mine today to talk about some recent results that I had the pleasure to work on recently. And the overall theme of my talk will be how can we study quantum complexity and take it from the notion of complexity in quantum computing and bring that back into physics and say something interesting about the fundamental aspects of quantum many-body systems. And so feel free to ask questions along the way. I might have a lot of material, but I can always adjust and go faster over the last slides in case. I'd prefer, if I make sure that everyone's on board and I didn't, leave someone behind. Okay, let me start by thanking my team. There we go. My wonderful team of collaborators. And I do want to thank, Jonas, Teja, and Jens, who are based in Berlin, and Anthony and Nicole, who are based in Maryland. This has been a wonderful collaboration. We had, multiple projects. We were kind of thinking about similar themes around the same time, and these resulted in very nice collaborations. And two contributions that I do want to highlight in particular, because they, in relation to my talk today, that is Jonas, who really took the lead on the topic that will be the first part of my talk on the linear growth of quantum complexity, and Teja, who was a master's student in our group in Berlin, and I proposed to him this project on complexity and entropy and work trade-offs in thermodynamics, and I had the pleasure to supervise his master's thesis on this topic. Those are results that I will be reporting in the second part of my talk. All right, now, the Hilbert space of n qubits is absolutely humongous. And the question is, do we really need all of those states? In physics, very often you end up looking at states that aren't necessarily very complex. There are states that you could, in principle, prepare using a few elementary operations. But very often we only consider a very tiny sliver of the entire space of all n qubits. And the idea is that, well, actually, physics currently, current topics in physics are increasingly pushing against this, which you can call this complexity frontier, where you're more and more looking at states that actually are very complex and for which you'd need longer and longer circuits to prepare on a quantum computer. Now, to kind of map out a little bit these different concepts and ideas that I have in mind, I drew a complexity axis here horizontally. Complexity being here, how many gates would I need, for instance, on a quantum computer to prepare my state? And physical concepts like, thermalization or even scrambling or topological phases or quantum error correction, they're actually, when you consider the whole breadth of this axis that goes from, zero to values that are exponential in n, they're actually pretty far on the left on this axis. These concepts kick in pretty early on the scale. Whereas concepts like quantum chaos or wormholes in quantum gravity, they tend to kick in much later on this, one of their major features is that they do really explore this whole complexity axis toward very deep regimes in complexity. And for completeness, I've also highlighted some standard states and representations that that we often encounter in quantum information, like GHC states or entangled states, tensor networks, variational onsets in quantum machine learning. They are typically relatively short circuits on this axis. We have some very good tools to explore states that are higher in complexity, like K-designs or random circuits. And even on the far right end of this axis, you could think of par random states. That's maybe what you could have in mind for a state that has maximal complexity. Now, the two main questions that I would like to focus on in my talk are, first of all, can we understand how quantum complexity grows in systems that exhibit some form of quantum chaos? And then in the second part of my talk, I'd like to think about, well, how does quantum complexity as a quantity, how can I think of it as a physical quantity, and how does it manifest itself in operational tasks, or what I can do with the system in terms of some operational tasks? And, you know, how can I try to bring quantum complexity really to some physical interpretation at that level? So this is the plan for my talk. The first part will be about the linear growth of quantum complexity in random circuits. I'll be thinking about pure states and random circuits mostly. In the second part of my talk, I will address the second question I just mentioned and draw a connection between complexity and entropy. And I'll be thinking about operational tasks on many-body systems, and I'll touch upon some ideas in the resource theory, from the resource theory framework. And, you know, in the third part, I'll have some outlook. All right, in the first part, so the linear complexity growth, first of all, you know, there's this important conjecture by Brown and Susskind that complexity is supposed to grow linearly in time if you have a quantum chaotic system. So if you have some chaotic system, you'd expect that this complexity kind of increases as time goes on up until it reaches the maximal value allowed by your quantum Hilbert space, which is exponential in M. And the basic context in which Brown and Susskind came up with this conjecture is quantum gravity. Now, if you let me kind of think of a black hole, you might have a picture like this in mind, where, you know, some kind of distortion of space-time with a singularity where that sucks matter in. And, you know, if you're misadventurous enough to actually fall into that black hole, then there's no way for you to travel back outside. So, you know, if you actually want to work with black holes, you'd prefer to have a picture like this, where you can see a little better what's going on. And here, the space that I represented on the previous slide is actually this wedge here on the right side of the diagram. This blue line is an observer that would be sitting outside of the black hole and kind of sitting at a finite distance from the black hole. And any stuff that would be falling into the black hole would be kind of these, would follow these world lines that kind of cross this black hole horizon here, that is right, this line right here. Now, the mathematical picture, you know, is completed by this additional stuff that we have here, which it really actually just means that the black hole can be described as having two, having event horizons with kind of two sides, if you like, the left side and right side, we like to, they're often called. And what I'll be doing is actually considering a more concrete example in ADS-CFT, a more concrete case in ADS-CFT. Now, what's important in ADS-CFT, and again, I guess there are, I'm sure there are many people in this audience who are way more expert than I am about this, but in ADS-CFT, the important principle is that whatever happens in this space, in this bulk of my theory, I can describe equivalently by something happening on the boundary of the space, which happens to be, in this case, two copies of a conformal field theory. Now, what this diagram depicts is this pretty much the same diagram as before, but now we have these boundaries on the side, which are two copies of a CFT. And they're, again, two sides of a black hole. And if we look at the time slice here, suitably defined time slice, then the states of the system, on this, the state of the CFTs is a thermal field double, which is some entangled state between both sides. You can think of it as a collection of bell pairs, pretty more or less informally. And now the idea is that if we kind of time evolve this time slice in here, we see that it kind of defines something that look that we can think of as a wormhole that is connected to the two horizons on each on each side of the black hole. And we know in ADS-CFT, everything that happens in the bulk, we're supposed to be able to describe it by something happening on the boundary. So, you know, what is the physical quantity on the boundary that corresponds to this wormhole length in the bulk? And there, and kind of the big idea behind Brown and Susskind's conjecture is that, well, that should be the complexity of the boundary states. You know, if I time evolve the boundary, I get some unitaries here, and the effect of that is to increase the complexity. And, you know, maybe we should be thinking of the complexity of the state as being dual to the wormhole length. And, you know, that led to their conjecture that complexity grows linearly in time. All right, I'll be doing a step here, which is very often done when you study many-body systems, that are, especially if they're chaotic. And that's, you know, instead of looking at a many-body Hamiltonian involving a collection of spins or something like that, I'll just look at a much simplified model where you start with a bunch of qubits that are in some standard state, which I'll choose to be the all-zero tensor product state. And I'll imagine that we just evolve by picking a gate at random, a two-qubit gate at random, and applying it onto the circuit. So we're going to apply a bunch of random two-qubit gates, and I'm going to study how the complexity evolves in time as we add more and more random gates. So intuitively, what we expect to happen is as I start to apply gates, well, this complexity should increase because we don't really expect here any cancellations. But what might happen, what you might suspect is that, well, maybe after a while, if I apply some gates and I like it, it might happen that by accident, I choose a collection of gates that, you know, by accident happen to cancel out to some simpler gate, right? That's what might happen if I choose these gates at random. And the basic intuition that I like to get through is that this basically never happens, or it happens with really vanishing probability. And really what happens is that this complexity continues to increase all the way until reaching, you know, the exponential values without any major cancellations. And I'll be focusing on how we could prove that. I see there's a question.
Yes. How do you define complexity in your... I thought it was related to the number of gates, but then it seems to be tautological with the slides that you have right now.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, sorry for the confusion. It is the number of gates, but it's the number of gates in the minimal circuit that I need to create the state. So in this case, if I apply gates, this might not be the optimal state. This might not be the optimal number of gates to, or I mean, if it's a state, it's a state, but if it's for unitary, I mean, it's similar, right? So this is one circuit that would generate a certain unitary or a certain state. And it might not be the most optimal one to generate. So the complexity would be the optimal one.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. There's another question.
I was wondering, implicitly in your diagram, it looks like you're imposing some sense of locality, like the gates only act on nearest neighbors. Is that really going to be the case? Or are you going to allow the two-bit gates to connect any two qubits in the system?
They can connect any two qubits.
Okay.
It's really a way of drawing them. That's a great question. Not to mention that. Thanks for asking.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Okay, thanks for those questions. It's good to clear that up. I forgot to mention these points. All right. So first of all, I do want to mention a very important... was that another question? Sorry, I see a hand that's still raised. No, okay. So the first thing I do want to mention is that there's an extraordinary tool to really study complexity growth in many body systems, and that's the idea of a K-design. And the idea is that if I pick a random circuit, actually, it comes very close to what we call a K-design. And a K-design is a notion of we say that a set of unitaries is a K-design if it's kind of evenly distributed all along the unitary, the space of all possible unitaries. And if it's kind of this evenly distributed, what you can show is that, you know, if you have a K-design, then a K-designs necessarily have, like the unitaries in a K-design necessarily have complexity that grows with this design degree K. And so that allows you to prove, for instance, polynomial growth, growth of complexity with a polynomial factor in time. And you do reach all the way up to exponential times. And, you know, that was, for instance, one of these major results in this paper by Brindau et al. A very useful tool for studying complexity growth has been these approaches based on K-designs. What I'll be doing is actually thinking about a slightly different approach. And I'd like to give you a little bit of intuition of what we do here. And, you know, we've probably all played with Google Earth or these map, you know, these kind of world exploring apps where you can rotate the globe around. And if you do a couple of rotations, even along standard axis, you quickly end up in a configuration of your Earth where you're kind of staring in the middle of in some random place with some very random orientation. And, you know, that might be surprising, but really what you're doing is, you know, you're doing independent rotations according to the in the space of all possible rotations. And so it's not really surprising that, you know, once you did essentially three rotations, you can specify any arbitrary rotation of the sphere. So, you know, it's not really surprising that you end up with something that looks extremely random. And the idea is I'd like to kind of port that intuition from the sphere, which only has 3 degrees of freedom, all the way to quantum circuits that actually has some exponential, you know, degrees of freedom. So the idea here that I'd like to convey is that in a random circuit, whenever you kind of add new gates, it's extremely likely that what you actually do is explore a new direction in this unitary space. And that in turn will actually translate, it turns out, into complexity growth. All right, so what our first result here that I want to talk about is a rigorous version of the idea that I just presented. So if I take a random circuit with R gates, R being less than 4 to the n, and where each gate is picked at random, say from the Haar measure, then the complexity of the unitary that I've sampled is necessarily lower bounded by something that grows linearly in the number of gates R. And that happens with unit probability. All right. And this constant L here is simply related to how connected the circuit is. I'll come back to that in a few slides. All right. So I'll try to give you a proof sketch of this theorem. And for that, I'll need to introduce a few things. So first, I need to tell you what an architecture is. And then I need to tell you what the accessible dimension of an architecture is. Then I need to kind of try to convince you that we can lower bounds this accessible dimension for an arbitrary, for a given architecture A. And in doing so, I'll need to introduce the concept of a backwards light cone. So I'm going to dive into more details. I turn on the fasten seatbelt sign. Don't be too worried. We'll fly out of the turbulence pretty soon. All right. So an architecture is simply defined as a certain layout according to which I want to place my gates. So it can be any arrangements, as was mentioned before. They don't have to be geometrically local. They can act on any two qubits. But they're just slots where I'm allowed to insert gates. I haven't defined which gates I put in there yet. But a given architecture has a certain number of gates. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to sample two qubit gates from the Haar measure, say on SU4, so the uniform measure on the two qubit gates, and I'm going to plug them into these slots. And that will give me my random circuit, right? The random circuit according to a fixed architecture. Now, what I just described, I can also describe in terms of what we call this contraction map. So now this map is simply the polynomial map that will take my choices that depends on a fixed architecture, right? And it will take my choices of random gates and it will contract them according to this architecture to give me a point in the space of all unitaries. And the object that I will be very interested in is the image of this map, which is simply the set of all possible unitaries that I can generate by picking gates in this architecture, right? This image is simply all of the unitaries that I can generate with circuits of this architecture, right? And this setting is interesting because we can really invoke now the toolbox of algebraic geometry. There are some very powerful principles that we can invoke to define really the dimension of this set in some rigorous way. We can define define the accessible dimension of an architecture as the dimension of this set, which we can really think of as the number of independent degrees of freedom that we need to describe this entire set. Okay, so I defined the accessible dimension. Now, can we actually characterize this accessible dimension in one way or another? And first thing is that we can do parameter. We can simply count parameters. And each gate can contribute at most 15 independent parameters. So those are the number of independent parameters of SU4. So we can very easily come up with this upper bound. If we are a little more careful in how we count parameters, we get this tighter bound, where we just removed some obvious redundancies in the parameters. Now the important thing is we need a lower bound on this accessible dimension. And in the following slides, I'll show you how we derived this lower bound. And I would consider this kind of the core technical part of our result. This is the kind of important part. Now, the strategy to lower bound this accessible dimension will be all we need to do is we need to find a single, so for a given architecture, all we need to do is we need to find a single choice of gates, what I've summarized in this X, such that the image of associated under this contraction map of these gates. I can perturb it in many different directions by perturbing gates. And that will tell me that I have many different degrees of freedom in the image as a result of perturbing these input gates. And that will give me a lower bound on the dimension of this image set. And the strategy we're going to follow is to pick these gates to be Clifford gates because that will come in handy later on. So what we do is we're going to pick some Clifford gates. I haven't told you which ones we're going to pick yet. But to identify the possible the directions in which we can perturb the image in this image set, we're going to have to perturb each of these gates by applying some small perturbation after each gate. And to identify the direction in which we're perturbing these perturbations generates in the image set, then we can compute the derivative of this whole circuit with respect to a single one of those perturbation parameters, epsilon jk. And if these perturbations are generated simply by two-qubit Pauli operators, the derivative will simply place out that Pauli operator immediately after my gate here. So, you know, this is this I can really interpret as the direction in which I'm perturbing the image if I perturb my gates and my circuit by this small parameter here. Now, this is where we use the fact that we chose Clifford gates, because when I have a Pauli operator here, what I can do is I can always send it to the end of the circuit past these different gates. And because Clifford, because the defining property of being a Clifford gate is that it maps Paulis to Paulis. So now what I have is I have my perturbation direction here. I can write it as a Pauli operator acting on the end of the circuit. And again, to summarize, so again, to repeat what I said before, we're going to try to choose these Clifford gates such that we can get as many independent Paulis here as possible. All right, this is where I need our assumption that the architecture is somehow sufficiently connected. And the way I'm going to introduce this assumption is that I'm going to say that there must be, you know, the architecture A has to be composed of blocks. You know, it has to be a concatenation of different blocks. And in each block, I must have at most a number L of gates. And in each block, I must have this property that for any qubit at the output of the block, each block must have this property that there exists a qubit at the output of the block, such that from any input qubit, I can go to that common qubit at the end of the block with paths that cross only through gates. So, you know, visually, it just means that at least if my gates are geometrically local like this, visually, it means that I have there exists a qubit on the output of the block that generates some backwards light cone that spans the entire inputs of the block, right? So that's what we were going to call this backwards light cone. Now, the reason we assume this specific notion of backwards light cone is that we need this following property right here. So when I have a block that has this backwards light cone, the cool thing is that if I'm given an arbitrary Pauli operator P on the input of the block, then I can always pick Cliffords within this block. I can always pick gates here that map this Pauli operator onto a single site Pauli Z operator at the output of the block. And you can just see that kind of iteratively by picking these Cliffords such that each time you reduce the Pauli operator, the weight of the Pauli operator until you reach really this single point at the output. So this is a property that our blocks have, and we're going to use that in an argument by induction to prove a lower bound on the accessible dimension. So let's imagine that we have proven after T prime blocks, we have an architecture with T prime blocks. Each of those blocks has this backward light cone. And we imagine that we have already proven that we have at least T prime independent directions in which I can perturb the circuit, represented here by T prime independent Pauli operators after the circuit. Well, let's pick any Pauli operator that is not among those T prime Pauli operators. So, you know, I'm assuming that T prime is not yet 4 to the n, right? It's less than 4 to the n. So, if I have less than 4 to the n independent Pauli operators here, I can definitely pick one Pauli operator that is not in the set. And what we want to show now is that if I add another block, then I'm going to have T prime plus 1 at least independent directions. For the new architecture with the T prime plus one blocks. And what we do is we pick one of those Pauli operators that is not among these that we already have. And we use the property I just described before to say that we can always pick Clifford gates here that will map this Pauli operator to a single site Z operator here. And this one is definitely, can definitely be written as, you know, the derivative of the last gate with respect to some parameter in here. So what we have is that and these guys also, we can also rewrite them by, you know, pushing them through the circuit and rewriting them at the end of the circuit if we want. But really what the important result that we have here is that after T prime plus one blocks, we have at least T prime plus one independent directions in which we can perturb this image. So that really means that the accessible dimension of these of this architecture with T prime plus one blocks is necessarily lower bounded by T prime plus one, but from, you know, this proof by induction. Okay, so we prove this lower bound, right? That the DA is lower bounded by something that's linear in the number of gates. I just rewrote the number of blocks in terms of the number of gates using the bound on the size of each block. We have the upper bound that comes from the parameter counting that I just mentioned before. And the result of that is that if I have an architecture, if I sample a circuit from an architecture A with R gates, then imagine imagine that I look at any architecture A prime with a number R prime of gates that satisfies this strict inequality, then the combination of these two inequalities tells us that the accessible dimension of A prime is strictly smaller than the accessible dimension of A. And so that means that if I sample a circuit from A, then to actually be in the image of an architecture A prime with this fewer gates, then it would have to land in a set of strictly smaller dimensionality. And that only happens with probability zero. So, you know, again, to so the idea is, again, if I sample a circuit from the architecture A, then it has zero chance of landing in an architecture with strictly smaller accessible dimension. And, you know, any and if I, you know, and that would mean that, so, you know, that means that, sorry, and those architectures are those, any architecture that has smaller than a linear fraction of gates of R, then necessarily this accessible dimension is indeed smaller. So what that means is that that's kind of the logic behind this theorem, is in that this is a theorem I showed you before, right? To reiterate, this is, we show that with unit probability, a random circuit that I've sampled according to some architecture with R gates has this lower bound on its complexity. And again, the logic, to reiterate the logic behind this, is that for the complexity to be lower than this right-hand side, what that would mean is that I actually landed in one of those image sets that has strictly smaller than dimensionality, and that only happens with probability lower, probability zero. Okay, so there are a lot of things that we can say about this result. I said that we sampled the gates according to the Haar measure on two-qubit gates, but actually we can use any measure that is absolutely continuous with respect to Haar. All we need to do is kind of these argument based on degrees of freedom. So you just need to make sure that everything works nicely on that end, but it doesn't have to be the Haar measure. We also have an extension of the results where the architecture itself can be chosen randomly. And the other interesting thing that I'd like to mention briefly is that this backwards light cone that we have is, we use it purely as a proof technique, but it is extremely similar to something that's called the switchback effect that's been encountered in the context of quantum gravity. And we're not quite sure actually if there is a conceptual connection or if it's more of a coincidence in that, you know, we use it as a technical device more than anything else. I do want to mention one, I would say a caveat of our result, that it really, everything that I've set up to here is really for the exact complexity. So it's not necessarily robust to small errors. So now this is something that you know, we can try to make robust, but, you know, making robust to small errors means that we can't use exactly the same proof techniques. We have to adapt some of these proof techniques, and it's not exactly clear how to do that. And I'll touch again on this point after the second part of my talk. All right, so that was the first part of my talk. Were there actually any questions along the way? Yeah, there's a question.
It's a very simple technical question. Way back at the beginning, when you restricted to the Clifford gates, normally when you do that, well, there's this well-known result about if you have circuits made only of Clifford gates, they're efficiently classically simulatable. Now, presumably that restriction doesn't cause trouble later, but I couldn't see how you're able to evade that problem.
That is a great question. I think the reason is that we're perturbing this Clifford. So we pick these Clifford gates here, but we are perturbing these gates in all possible directions here on the two-qubit gates here. So we're really kind of doing perturbations according to all possible directions in SU4. And that, of course, includes non-Clifford gates. So in principle, you could even imagine situations where you pick all of these gates to be the identity and still be able to say something interesting by looking at, you know, different perturbation directions here. But I think this is really the point where you evade this this limitation, right, of, you know, in fact, you can simulate Clifford circuits. That's a great question.
Okay, so that's how you sneak in something that's the equivalent of a T gate. Yeah. Right, as a perturbation on something that's in the Clifford set.
Yeah, I would say that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Cool.
Thanks.
Hi, could I ask a question about the definition of sufficiently connected?
Of course.
So are there architectures that are connected but not sufficiently connected?
I guess the answer, like, we need some form of, so I guess I use sufficiently connected in I just use this as definition for being sufficiently connected. I'm not sure what you would mean exactly by connected. One thing that is important is that kind of the circuit keeps on mixing up all of these different qubits at a good rate, you know, because what happens is that if my circuit only applied gates to the first few qubits, for instance, then obviously, you know, we might have problems because the complexity wouldn't increase past the complexity that you could get on those few qubits, right? So we need some kind of assumption that that the circuit is kind of sufficiently connected in a certain sense.
I'm just wondering if there's like some non-trivial architecture, you know, that's not just some, you know, trivial decoupled blocks that are evolving, like some kind of, you know, connected architecture in which it's not sufficiently connected, so somehow the complexity would not increase linearly in time for a random ensemble with that geometry. Maybe some kind of dynamics where there is, you know, some shortcut, right?
For instance, would it be okay if you had two sufficiently connected circuits with just a single gate coupling them somewhere in the middle? Would that itself be sufficiently connected?
I think it would, yeah, because you could pick a qubit right after that gate that connects. So you'd have to put that gate that connects both parts. You'd have to put it after the two blocks of sufficiently connected, you know, disjoint sufficiently connected circuits. You'd put one gate that couples them at the output, and then you satisfy this definition, right? You have a qubit at the output that you could reach from any possible input qubit by paths that go through the gates. So in that case, yes, that would be sufficiently connected.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, I mean, whenever you have a staircase of gates that kind of crosses through the circuit, then automatically you're sufficiently connected after that number of gates. So of course, there's still this L parameter they can play with, you know. If you have an architecture that has some degree of connection, then maybe just by looking at larger and larger blocks, you might end up having a sufficiently connected architecture according to this definition. So I would be maybe like this, you know, for a circuit to not satisfy this definition for a certain number, for a certain size, for some L sufficiently large, then you would probably have to have pieces that are completely disconnected.
Okay, thanks.
Could you take John's example, though, and put the gate at the beginning? Doesn't that give sort of, it's maybe a trivial example, but an example that it would not be sufficiently connected then?
You're right, of course, but I'm thinking of these blocks as being, you know, concatenated blocks together. You know, you're looking at an architecture of many of these blocks together because that's where you can prove this linear growth. So in that case, you know, you would, of course, the arrangement that you're suggesting wouldn't satisfy this definition, but then you could choose your block slightly differently and it would actually satisfy this definition.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Hilary, you want to have another question?
Well, I don't know if it's a question or a comment. I just wanted to pick up on this connectivity issue. And I'm thinking that this system, this question about connectivity should, don't have to say this. I'm thinking percolation transition, right? There should be something in the structure of this as you increase the connectivity or reduce it that gives you a percolation transition. But as I said, it's just a comment. I can't get a coherent question out of that. Just, you know, does this system do that?
Are you kind of, can I interpret that as, you know, if I have too few gates, then I'll have trouble finding my paths because I won't be able to kind of percolate through the absence of gates in the block.
Yeah, I think it should look something like that.
Yeah, I think in that case, what you could say is that, you know, indeed, you know, you'd have to add more gates. You know, you'd have to look at longer and longer definitions of blocks for this sufficiently connected condition to apply.
So that, I mean, I think maybe that might be the natural definition of connectivity in this particular context, right? Is to look for that transition.
Yeah maybe. Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks.
Okay.
Debbie, you have a question?
Right. So your architecture does not exclude the possibility that you can have from the right-hand side, increasingly narrow, and then there is a pinch in the middle. There's only one 2-qubit gate in the middle, and then you expand it back again on the right hand, on the other end. So you have this kind of two triangle meeting in only one single spot in the middle. That's not excluded, right?
So you could, that's a very good question. You could, of course, consider that as an architecture. You would have to define, so you could use the first triangle that could define a block that satisfies this condition here. The second one would not, right? So you'd have to see how you continue, you know, how you continue, what other blocks are you adding? Are you repeating the same structure over and over again? In which case you would have to kind of look at, I guess, the two triangles defined in a suitable way, and that would satisfy this connectivity criterion.
So can you clarify again what level of randomness or the blocking we are allowed in this process?
Mm-hmm. Sure. What I'm assuming is that the architecture, so the, again, I want to lower bound the accessible dimension of an architecture. So the assumption is the architecture can be written as a concatenation of a certain number of blocks that have this property here. So, but I'm allowed to choose, that's an assumption of my theorem. I'm allowed to choose how I define these blocks. And that might influence the lower bound that I get.
Thank you. Right.
Okay. Thanks. So those are actually wonderful questions. Thanks for asking them. So if there are no more questions about this part, let me move on to the second part of my talk. And that's about how to connect, you know, complexity and entropy, and how to bring in operational tasks into the picture. So maybe one way of phrasing where I want to go is, I showed you this complexity axis kind of at the beginning of my talk, where we can consider at least all the pure states. If we keep this definition of minimal preparation circuits with unitaries, and there's this notion of second law of complexity that says that systems tend to, under the right circumstances, to always evolve kind of towards greater and greater complexities. And this looks a lot, of course, like another axis that we already know from thermodynamics, which is, you know, it would be the entropy axis, where we consider kind of all states and kind of organize them according to how mixed they are. And again, in the right circumstances, in the right assumptions, we have the second law of thermodynamics that tell us that systems ever only tend to evolve to greater and greater values of this entropy as time evolves. And the question kind of I want to ask is, there, can we really understand how these axes are connected? And can we even combine these quantities to have something here in the middle between these two axes? Again, this is only a very kind of rough picture of the intuition that I'd like to convey here. And for that, what I want to do is come back again to this axis here of entropy. I want to go back to what we did in thermodynamics and to see how to consider operational tasks that are considered in thermodynamics, and to see how we can add a notion of complexity there. All right, so one of the most important concepts when you look at information thermodynamics is that's the idea of Lindauer's principle. So I'm going to kind of take a little detour here and briefly introduce Lindauer erasure here. The idea is, if I have a computer with a memory register that has some information, which, you know, whatever was left over from the previous user of that memory register, and I need it to do some new computation, what I have to do is I first have to reset that memory register to some useful state, some known state, the all zero state. And this reset operation is something that has been, you know, considered many times already. And the important thing is I need thermodynamic work to carry it out. And the reason I need thermodynamic work intuitively is simply because if I look at what happens to the environment, well, you know, in my computer, this entropy, this information entropy that I had in my memory register has to go somewhere. And, you know, I have to interpret that it as this entropy is dumped into the environment. And because the entropy of the environment increases, necessarily there's some heat dissipation from the laws of thermodynamics. And that means that I had to invest somehow some work that enabled this erasure to happen in the first place. And, you know, there's been a bunch of a big chunk of literature that has really studied this question of this setting of Lindauer erasure. And the big punchline that comes out of that is that if I want to reset one bit of information from an unknown state to a definite zero state, whether it's a classical bit or a qubit, it turns out kind of very similar. What I need to do is I need to invest an amount of work that is equal to kT times log 2. T is the environment of the, T is the temperature of the environment of that acts as a heat bath in the erasure process. Okay. So If all of that was a little bit abstract, and you might say I'm waving my hands a lot here, actually all of this can be very well formalized in the resource theory of thermodynamics. I mean, you can also work out stat mech models. I mean, it's been extensively studied, but you know, one concrete way of really formalizing all of this is the resource theory of thermodynamics, and there's been a lot of literature on that. All right. So the setting I'd like to consider today is that imagine that I have a pure state and I want to reset it to the all zero state. Well, this is a setting that's a little different because now the pure state actually means that I can find a unitary that brings that pure state all the way back to the all zero state. And you know, at least in these models of thermodynamics that we consider, usually unitaries are reversible operations. Let's not worry about energetic considerations. Let's imagine that the Hamiltonian of this register is completely degenerate. So this unitary really conserves energy strictly. So that means that I can do it at no work cost in principle. So really what I can do is I can reset my state psi to the all zero states at zero work cost by running the circuit that undoes this pure state all the way to the all zero state. But imagine that this state is actually a very complex state. This uncomputation would actually take an exponential amount of time because I'd have to apply an exponential number of gates. And where I said that this I can do at no work cost, what I'm really doing is I'm hiding the fact that there's a huge complexity cost potentially in resetting the state using a protocol like this. So that's really a caveat of this protocol. On the other hand, maybe I could just, you know, instead of uncomputing the state, I could just pretend that it's a state that I don't know what it is, and I just run the Landauer erasure protocol that I mentioned earlier. I mentioned earlier we can pay kT log to thermodynamic work, and there's a protocol that will reset any state to the any qubit state to the zero state. So I can, if I want to reset my memory register, maybe a smarter thing to do here would just be to pay n qubits worth of erasure work, you know, apply Landauer erasure to these n qubits, disregarding the fact that it's actually a pure state. And now I have a work cost, but I have no complexity cost. I didn't have to run any long computation. So what this example points to is that there seems to be some kind of general trade-off between the amount of work that I have to put in to reset a state and the amount of complexity, the complexity cost associated with resetting the state. So I'd like to quantify this trade-off. So to do that, I'm going to consider the general case. We have a general state rho, and we want to bring the state rho to the all zero pure state. That is our task. Now, the rules, what we're allowed to do is we're allowed to apply at most R gates. You know, these I'm allowed to place these gates the way I want. And the point is after my circuit of R gates, what I need is I need a certain number of these qubits to already be in the pure zero states. And then whatever's left, I will have to pay work to erase, right? So what my task is here is to maximize this number of qubits that are left in the zero state. So this is our second result that I like to highlight in this talk. The optimal number of qubits k is simply n minus some quantity here that I'll define on the next slide, which is a new entropy measure. And this is a new entropy measure that accounts for the complexity of the states. As it accounts for the fact that we can only apply R gates here. Now, just for completeness, you know, if I didn't have this restriction on how many gates I can apply here, the optimal answer would be something like the entropy of rho, and that's because we can do data compression. You can always kind of take rho, compress the information in rho onto the smallest number of qubits that you need to contain this information, and then you'd only have to reset these qubits, and the number of qubits here is simply given by the, you know, data compression is characterized by the entropy of the state. If it's in the one-shot setting, it's a one-shot entropy measure. But here, what happens is we have a generalization of that accounts for our restriction complexity. And so this is why I'm calling this an entropy measure, because it generalizes that setting. Now, this entropy measure is defined as follows. I want to think about this entropy as it's the amount of randomness or the amount of entropy that the state appears to have if you can only ever really access it with observables of complexity at most R. So I don't have too much time to go into details here, but for those of you who know the hypothesis testing entropy, it's really just a extension of the hypothesis testing entropy to the case where you want to account for complexity. And the definition is, you can think of it like this. It's I optimize over all possible POVM effects, which I deem to be of complexity at most R. I need to define what that means, but let's just think of it as it's a projective measurement that's a tensor product of projectors onto qubits after I've done some circuits of size R. And what I need is that I need this projector to capture at least this amount of weight of the state rho. And what I want is I want to find this projector that satisfies this condition that has the smallest amount of trace, the smallest trace. And so, you know, to give you an idea, if rho is a pure state and I'm allowed an arbitrarily complex measurement, what I could do is I could just choose the projector onto the state itself. And that would give me a trace that's equal to one, so an entropy equal to zero, right? So that's kind of an extreme case if you'd like to have in mind. All right, so this is the definition of our complexity entropy. And and to give you a little bit of an idea of how it behaves, this is kind of how I'd like to think about how it behaves, right? So if I plot this entropy as a function of R, what we'd expect is that at very small values of R, the state might look very mixed because, you know, if I want to capture all of the weight of the state, I just simply need either a projector that's, you know, basically equal to the identity, or you know, I might have to resort to a projector that has a very high rank, a very high trace, in order to be able to capture the weight of my entire state. But as I increase this parameter R, what will happen is that I'll be able to resolve kind of the details of the state to a better and better resolution. And maybe even at some point, I'll be able to implement the optimal projector that would correspond to the value of the entropy if I had no complexity restriction at all. So that means that I would kind of recover this hypothesis-testing entropy that I mentioned earlier. So, you know, we can prove some properties of this entropy measure. It's monotonous in these parameters R and eta. It has values between 0 and n if you define it properly. We can recover the hypothesis-testing entropy in the limit where R goes to infinity. There's some fine print to that, which I didn't really want to go into detail. Some interesting things for those of you, who are familiar with entropy measures. Usually entropy measures, they always satisfy these kind of key properties like data processing and the data processing inequality, or the, you know, unitary invariance, which are, you know, key properties of entropy measures. Well, you know, the complexity entropy cannot satisfy those properties, and that's really by design. You know, usually in entropy, it doesn't matter if I rotate the states by a unitary, the entropy is always the same. Well, in this case, that's, you know, by design no longer the case, because if I rotate my states with some unitary, I might actually turn it a simple state into something that's very complex. And now it suddenly looks like it has a lot of entropy if I'm only allowed simple measurements. So there are these properties that are kind of no longer, that simply by design no longer apply. And the other interesting thing is that kind of this profile here can give us a way of defining a notions of complexity for mixed states. And it kind of recovers the idea of the strong complexity that was introduced by Brandao et al. In this paper here. And, you know, what you could say is that, well, I could define the complexity of a state as how complex do I need to choose my observable, my projector in the definition of the complexity entropy, such that I can actually resolve the true entropy of my state here. Or I could ask a slightly different question. I could say, well, how complex do I need to choose my observable so that I can start resolving some difference with basically the maximally mixed state. And this, for instance, this line here would correspond, for instance, to the notion of strong complexity, at least in the case of pure states that was introduced in these and in the Fernando's paper et al. All right. So that was kind of the second part of my talk that I wanted to mention about complexity and entropy. Now I'd like to shift more to the outlook and how we can actually use these and maybe combine even the two parts of my talk and to get you to say things about many body systems. So really, to reiterate the operational meaning of this complexity entropy that I've introduced, that is the amount of work that is required in order to reset a state to the all zero states in the eyes of an agent that can only perform at most, you know, a certain limited number of gates. And we do conjecture that in at least in certain parameter regimes, probably not for all parameter regimes, but at least in some parameter regimes, that this entropy measure is something that's monotone, what's called monotone resource theory of complexity. So, you know, I didn't want to go here in too much detail because I realized I would have too much content, but we can build a resource theory where that captures this idea that complexity only tends to increase as you apply more and more operations. And we believe that, you know, a version at least some version of this complexity entropy might actually be a monotone of this resource theory, meaning that it can only increase as you apply more and more of these free operations. And I think one way we could think about this entropy, if that kind of turns out to be the case, is that it would be some kind of unification of the second laws of thermodynamics and the second law of complexity. Because by saying that this quantity increases for all values of R, it's kind of telling you that my state can only ever look more mixed as time evolves, whatever the resolution at which I look at it. So that kind of captures both the ideas that it looks more mixed because it gets more complex, or because it gets more actual entropy. And finally, you know, we can start thinking, well, once we have a notion of entropy that actually accounts for complexity, can we start imagining using it in other areas of physics where actually complexity starts being important? You know, in statistical mechanics, one of the basic ideas of statistical mechanics is to say, when you define the entropy, you know, you typically look at the entropy of at the distribution of local observables or something like that. You have to do some kind of coarse graining to get some entropy. And this kind of, again, is a notion that is captured by this complexity awareness. And you could imagine that this might be a candidate quantity to say interesting things about systems where the state becomes more and more complex. All right, now I have hope that this entropy is actually a tool that can be useful to prove complexity growth for kind of a bunch of different settings. And this is kind of to connect the two parts of my talk now in a more clear way. And for instance, we could look at, you know, the random circuits, the type of proof technique that I used for our first results. We can ask, you know, can we show really a growth of this entropy in a certain way for random circuits in this sense? And what I would imagine is that maybe if I have a system that evolves in time, I could look at the entropy profile as a function of this R parameter. And maybe at the very beginning, I have some very simple state. So it might even be a pure state. So it might have a very low entropy across this whole profile, but I could imagine as time evolves, I would have my state would actually look very mixed if I can only probe it with simple observables, and it would start looking pure only if I had deep enough observables to probe it with. And as time evolves, kind of this whole profile would shift over to the right, and that would be kind of a signature of complexity growth in these types of systems. So we can also try to repeat the type of proof that is in Fernando's paper with K-designs in terms of this entropy. And that could provide a sanity check, if you like, and possible ideas for extension to mixed states and open system dynamics. And you know, we could try to see, does this give us any new approach for looking at an actual chaotic Hamiltonian and not having to first go through this random circuit? And you know, can we think about open system dynamics? Can we think about notions of complexity phase transitions? Can this be a useful tool to probe these types of setting? I think that those are interesting questions to explore. Then, you know, there are a lot of things that we can still ask about the entropy itself. So I mentioned it's a notion of data compression where you have computational limitations. So, you know, this complexity entropy answers the question of how many qubits do I need to encode a state if I want my encoding, my data compression algorithm to consist of at most R gates. And, you know, we could try to think of questions like, can this entropy now be useful for quantifying something like pseudorandomness? You know, this is how random my state appears if I can only probe it with some limited complexity. And there's a bunch of questions on the thermodynamic side that we can ask as well. You know, what happens if I look at thermodynamic erasure, not just the simple thermodynamic erasure that I showed you, but the thermodynamic erasure where maybe I'm allowed to even use a quantum memory? Or, you know, can I ask questions that go beyond the thermodynamic erasure and ask, what if I have the general completely positive map that I want to implement? How much work do I need to implement it using at most, you know, R gates? Or, you know, questions of that notion. And I also wanted to mention that there are other ideas in considering notions of complexity within the framework of thermodynamics itself. For now, what I've been doing is I've been looking at, you know, in the information processing part, I've been separating that from the pure thermodynamic aspects of the framework. But, you know, you can ask, is there a way to really dig into this thermodynamic framework as well and start accounting for complexity in that area as well? So anyway, now, you can tell me, you know, for those of you who might know, there are a lot of entropy measures out there. You know, there's been a lot of different definitions of entropy measures that characterize different operational tasks, data compression, randomness extraction, communication, and so on. And you could ask, was it really, do we really need an extra entropy measure? And, how does it fit into this? At some point in the past, I was really confused by all of these entropy measures. So I drew this diagram of how to relate them together to help me out, sorting them out. And, kind of where does this new entropy measure fit? I would argue it actually fits in a new kind of dimension. All of these entropies, they don't care about the complexity of the state. They're unitarily invariant. So I think the entropy that we're introducing here, this complexity entropy, would be something that kind of goes beyond the entropies that we already have. And, there have been also other proposals for some kind of similar notions of entropy with, computational entropies. And we can start asking, well, how are they related? Definitions are different. How are they related? And, does it make sense to try to extend other versions of these entropy measures and extend them also to make them aware of complexity? And, we can start thinking about how to define a relative entropy or a mutual information or a conditional entropy. Is there a notion of asymptotic equipartition that might actually relate to the entropy that I just introduced, which is a kind of a one-shot type entropy and related to some von Neumann type entropy, maybe in some IID limit. So, that's, I think the message I'm trying to get through here is that I think there's a lot of structure here that we can still explore, and it sounds interesting. And there are a bunch of open questions that we can still explore. I think, it kind of, like, you can sort them in categories of the type, can we actually compute this entropy measure? That's something, that's tricky because, this optimization is over some set that's really hard to characterize. It's not a semi-definite program. Even if you kind of take some kind of convex hull, some kind of convex relaxation of it, it's a polytope that you need exponentially number of constraints to actually define. So computing this complexity entropy in general, I mean, you'd expect it to be hard because we believe that computing the complexity itself should be hard. So the question would be more like, can we find useful bounds that would apply in some limited regimes but that could still be useful in some maybe regimes of low complexity? Maybe we can use bounds based on entanglements, or maybe we can use bounds based on some notion of on some relation with k-designs. And, there are a bunch of other connections or extensions that I'd be interested in, and how you extend this to continuous variable systems, and also what happens if you look at other notions of complexity for how you define the complexity of the observable, right? You could look at the Nielsen complexity instead, and maybe hopefully try to say something back in the setting of quantum gravity, where this kind of whole idea of complexity growth started off as partly. And, we can try to find other connections with quantum error correction or quantum machine learning, which are, other topics that I could be interested about. So yeah, with that, I think I've said a lot, and I really do want to thank you for your attention and for your great questions.
Okay, great. Thanks for the great talk. So it's time for questions. Maybe.
And so in the definition for the complexity for the complexity measure for the effect, is it something to, like, is it defined on the actual PUVM element, or is it actually on the measurement circuit itself? Like, what's the complexity defined on?
That's a very good question. I didn't tell you what it was, right? So the set MR, let me define it in a concrete way let me define first a set M0. The set M0 would be the set of all tensor product projectors across all qubits. So let's say even the tensor product, let's say for concreteness, let's take it's a tensor product of projectors, and each projector is either the projector onto the zero state or the identity projector. Right, on each qubit, I either choose the identity or a projector project onto the zero state, and that gives me a projector. And that the set of all possible projectors like this, I define that to be the M0 sets. And then the MR set for some finite R would be this projector conjugated by some unitary of complexity R. And then the unitary complexity can simply be the circuit complexity, for instance.
Thanks.
David? Hi, thanks for the talk. So I was going to ask you about the connections to magic. I mean, you had on your last slide a something about connections to magic. So I wanted to just ask if you wanted to say something about that.
Well, mostly what I that's something that I really want to explore because I haven't really had I don't have a clear picture of what the connections exactly should be. There has to be some kind of connection, I believe, because in both cases, what you're saying is you're trying to describe, you know, you're looking at state space or unitary space, and you're trying to describe how can you reach kind of various corners in the space. And kind of you can think of these sets and these MR sets as kind of being these sets where that kind of try to capture more and more all of these different corners of state space or unitary space. And it's what strikes me is that, yeah, when you look at magic, you have some kind of similar idea that, you know, you're trying to go beyond, go beyond Clifford operations, and you try to kind of reach all of those different corners of your unitary space that are hard to reach. And, you know, I was kind of at that level of analogy, it feels to me that there should be some kind of connection that would, you know, maybe allow us to say, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the connection would be, but kind of this idea of trying to characterize how you could go and reach those different corners of unitary space seems to be common. And, you know, maybe there's some connection there to explore.
Thanks.
Rob?
Yeah, hi, Philip. Thanks for the talk. I remember many years ago, Ben Schumacher did some work talking about the algorithmic information cost of Landau erasure. And I don't remember the details, but is what you're talking about related to that at all or no?
That's a good question. That rings a bell. I don't remember exactly what he did there. There are a lot of different notions out there. There's been, you know, algorithmic cost. There's, you know, you can think about the Kolmogorov complexity of the of your state and so on. I'd have to look up again what he did there. I don't recall seeing this particular notion of entropy, your kind of apparent entropy if you're allowed to probe your system at a certain level of complexity. But that might be something I have missed. So I could have to look again.
It definitely feels different. I agree. And in fact, if I recall correctly, Schumacher was interested in Kolmogorov complexity, whereas the kind of complexity you're talking about, I think, is more in line with, for example, Charlie Bennett's notion of logical depth. Have I got that right? That, you know, it's that the big difference would be that, you know, you can maximize the Kolmogorov complexity by having a completely random string, but the, you know, the logical depth of the shortest program that generates that is just to sort of print that string, and, you know, regular periodic things have short logical depth as well. So they feel like different concepts, and yours is more in line with logical depth, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, thanks.
Actually, I have a question. So, yeah, I have two questions. So first is, is this related to coarse-grained entropy?
This paper here by Gilman and Hartley.
Yeah. So in this case, do you expect that this quantity, complexity, entropy? Well, I think it stems from the same philosophy, but are there any related, like it's a lower bound or upper bound or?
That's a great question. I would conjecture, I think I have a proof sketch for one direction. I would conjecture that you would actually get some kind of asymptotic equipartition property that would say that the quantity that we introduced would converge to that type of coarse-grained entropy in some kind of IID limit under the right parameter regimes. So kind of, I can try to explain what I mean by that. So if I look at this diagram, you have entropies that are kind of in the one-shot regime, which characterize operations that you typically do a single time. Like if I do data compression only once, then the number of bits that I need to compress my data, you know, there might be fluctuations, I need to account for them. So I need to kind of pack some extra bits in case I have a message that's longer. And those one-shot entropies differ from the von Neumann entropy, which is kind of averaged over all of these repetitions, right? And the type of entropy that we defined is a one-shot type entropy. You know, I want to erase it a single instance. Whereas the coarse-grained entropy that was introduced in this paper here, I believe it's more something like a IID type quantity because it's based on the von Neumann entropy. So in the case where you don't have this complexity restriction, we know that these one-shot entropies typically converge to the von Neumann entropy in the IID limits. And I would conjecture that something similar would happen here. And you know, that this one-shot type complexity entropy would converge to some version of this coarse-grained entropy in the IID limits. That's something I'd like to try to prove.
So would you expect that if you compute this quantity for a black hole, it will be a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, or?
That's a great question. It depends on everything, on the setting that we look through. And I think it would be wonderful if that's actually the case, you know. But then you could also ask, do we really need to, if we're interested, I need to think about it, you know, since the black hole scrambles so easily, you could say that you don't need some fancy notion of complexity entropy. You could just look at local observables, and this thing should already thermalize very quickly. And maybe, you know, it should suffice to look at an entropy of that type to try to, you know, as like you would do in statistical mechanics, to try to define an entropy, a meaningful entropy for a black hole. But I would need to think about it. So I think really deeply about that. That's a great question.
I have one more question. So more like adding to Rob's question. So is it something interesting to think about, like, of course, you're thinking about like a complexity of returning to zero states, but you could also think about like finding such a undoing unitary is also pretty complex, right? And then typically I believe there was like a paper from condensed matter community which actually studies like you have a gate which is running up to scrambling time or like beyond the scrambling time, and they ask, can we entangle it? And so then they found that across the scrambling time, like complexity, or I would say measuring complexity, it just seems to be usually like there is a sudden phase transition complexity of measuring complexity. So is there something might be interesting to look at, or I don't know.
Yeah, you know, of course, you're absolutely correct. You know, if you look at computer science, you know, my understanding is, for instance, computer scientists really worry about this with great reason, as in, you know, if you want to find an algorithm for erasure, for instance, correct me if I got your question right, you know, if I didn't get your question right, if, you know, you can ask, okay, it's nice to have a circuit with you know, at most R gates, but I didn't worry at all about how do I find the circuit? And, you know, if it's really complicated to find the circuit in the first place, maybe it's, you know, it's not really useful to know what this value is, because, you know, I would never be able to find the circuit. And that's right. I think that's something that, for instance, typically in computer science, you really worry about that. And I didn't worry about it here. I guess it's really just to decouple the different problems. But I think you're right. And ultimately, that's something that would have to be taken into account as well. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah. I mean, right. So any other question? If not, let's thank Philip again.
Thanks for listening. Sorry for going over time.
That's perfectly fine. So, Philip, we are supposed to meet in like 45 minutes or so, right?
I guess. Sounds great.
And are you tired? Or, I mean, if you want to start a bit like, not now, but I think several minutes later, that's fine for me as well. So
whatever works for you. You know, I could use a short break right now, but if it's, you know, whether it's in 15 minutes or 45 minutes.
Then why don't we start from like a 12:30, which is, I don't know. So it's like 15 minutes.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. All right. All right. Thanks.
Hey, sorry, can I ask a quick question?
Of course.
Do you have some specific example of the your complexity entropy beyond the heuristics?
What do you mean by example? Like, did I?
For example, calculation. Like, how do you really calculate for this quantity for some specific state? Do you have some calculation examples? Yeah, I just want to understand this quantity better.
That's a great question. So, of course, in general, this quantity is hard to compute. Right? To compute in general. What you can do is, for instance, to think about an example, like imagine you have a GHZ state, right? The way you would prepare a GHZ state is, you know, for instance, you do a Hadamard and then a sequence of CNOS, right? Mm-hmm. So what you want to do in that case, so in that case, you can kind of compute things kind of, fairly see the value of this entropy for different values of R, right? First of all, if R is equal to zero, you know, if you're only allowed to look at individual qubits, all of these qubits, they look mixed. So if you want to capture the whole weight of the state, you need to pick here the identity operator. And that means that your GHZ state looks like it has maximal entropy. It looks like you have n gates of entropy in there. On the other hand, if R is something like n, or it's larger, or any value larger than n, then you can take you can actually uncompute your GHZ state. You can use your circuit to prepare this GHZ state and do that kind of optimal measurement, like just measure the all zero states at the end, and you're sure to always succeed in that measurement. And so you can always pick this projector. In that case, the trace is equal to one, and you have the entropy equal to zero. And well, in between, you can kind of see that you'll have some intermediate regime where I guess the optimal circuit will be something that you've uncomputed part of your GHZ state, but then kind of you're still left with something that you didn't manage to uncompute on the rest, and you'll have to use some identity operators on those qubits and, you know, zeros on the rest. So it's going to be some intermediate value.
Yeah, sure thing. The intuition is definitely okay. I'm just curious. For example, if you want to do some numerics on this quantity, like, how are you ever going to be able to do it? Or maybe my question is, do you have some easily computable bounds on this kind of quantity?
Well, you know, that was really kind of one thing that I hoped to get at some point. Where was the slide here? Really, that's what I meant to emphasize with this point. I think it's a super important point because of what you say. You know, we want to understand this quantity better. We better be able to compute it for something, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't see how to do that.
I understand that. Well, first of all, I think I would expect we can still say something when this value of R is fairly small. If we look at something that's less than maybe the system size, then we can probably use entanglement bounds, or just even Libra, or if you have some geometrically or locality, if you say that your gates can only be geometrically local, you can maybe even use Lieb-Robinson bounds to say that, well, maybe, okay, I'll at most be able to uncompute part of the state, or to, you know, you can try to combine these to get some bounds on the complexity entropy. I would imagine that there are ways of connecting the notion of how entangled your state is across, say, different bipartitions, reasoning on entanglement entropies, to tell you that, well, actually, you to come up with some bounds on this complexity entropy. Now, if R starts growing larger than the system size, we're trying to think of, you know, if can we use some notion of can we integrate some notion of k-design? Can we choose, for instance, these operators to, in the definition of the entropy, can we choose them to be elements of a k-design instead of being, you know, random circuits? And can we use that to try to, you know, get some bound out of that?
That might be a good point. Yeah,
it doesn't look easy because we have this optimization, and I'm not sure how to deal with that. But those are kind of ideas that I'd hope to exploit to get bounds.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Sure.